I have a question which is sort of a spin-off from the very first question about the efficiency of the engines and the quote-unquote possible resurrection of the Concorde. Is there indeed an organization or a group of organizations that work in Britain similar to the Vulcan to the Sky project that are looking at this as a real possibility as opposed to just pie in the sky?
In simple terms, no, at the moment. There are many people who'd like to think that maybe they could do it. But the Vulcan is a complicated aircraft in itself, and it's rare to get such a large military four-engine delta-wing bomber like that in a situation where it can fly again, and to get approval from all the authorities. Well, Concorde is more complicated, would be more difficult by a factor of several times more complicated. And so it's going to cost a heck of a lot more money. There is no move at the moment to actually raise that money, and there's no indication from the authorities that even if the work was done, they'd actually give permission to actually fly the aircraft. That doesn't mean it'll never happen, and I hope I'm tempting fate, perhaps it will. But at the moment, I'm not aware of, and I'm quite close to some of these things, that there's any move to do that.
Any other questions while we're waiting for one? Tony, has there been any incident? I mean, you've been in flying, 46 years. Is there any one incident that kind of stands out?
Yeah, it does, Jerry. Would you mind if I answer it at the end? It was really one of the worst incidents I think you can have with any. I would prefer to wait until a little later on to answer it. Otherwise, it's very vivid memories.
Okay.
We have one right in the center here.
Go ahead, and then I'll get a couple up here. Okay.
Okay, I know it's a highly debated topic, and you know I've seen videos and stuff on it, but can the Concorde be rolled? And if it can, has any of you guys done it?
Not by me.
Not by me either, but I was there.
And the important thing... Sorry.
Well, I don't know whether the previous presenter is in the building or whether he has left the building. I wouldn't like to compromise any of his colleagues who may happen to live in the Toulouse area.
He's left the building.
Oh, in that case, then, right. Right. It was back in 1981 when there was a proposal, a modification, in fact, a mandatory modification, drafted out by our good friends in Aerospatiale, and it was a tire deflation detection system. We had been suffering from a number of punctures. And myself and a flight manager colleague were invited down to see a demonstration of this. The first day was awful. It involved the worst abuse cases that you could ever imagine in taxiing an airplane. We were taken out for a meal that night, and there was a bit of a nudge. Tomorrow, if the weather is good, we may show you something quite interesting. The next day's program was the heavyweight takeoff, giving the airplane a lot of rudder down the runway. Again, the abuse case, just to show that the tire deflation system would work in normal circumstances, when it was required to, but wouldn't come up with false warnings in these cases. So we got airborne on a crisp, clear autumn day and flew up to 15,000 feet in the vicinity of Toulouse, and round we went in a barrel roll. Our manager was sitting in the right-hand seat, a qualified co-pilot, a qualified Concorde pilot also, and it was put to him, well, we've rolled it one way, would you like to unroll it the other way? No, he said, no, it's your airplane after all. Go on, said his friend. All right, then I will, yes. And so he did the second one. That's as much as I can say.
Let me do a follow-up to that. Based on what he's saying, I think prior to the crash in 2000, were you all expecting that Concorde was going to be retired because it was becoming a very tired aircraft, structurally unsound, or did she have a much longer shelf life?
The first point you made, were we expecting it to retire? No. Because in the late 90s, we were aware, we were using our seven aircraft quite heavily. We were using them a lot, as much as you could perhaps with a Mark II aeroplane, making healthy money for the company out of the aeroplane, and it was they were all flying, being used, as I say, quite a lot. When we bought the aircraft, we were given an aircraft with a fixed life of it on it. The number of flights, supersonic flights, were considered a cycle. Shorter flights, part of a cycle, and so on. And the aircraft was guaranteed by the manufacturers up to a limited number of cycles, 6,800 cycles. They thought when they made it that nobody would ever operate that many cycles, so they didn't think it was a problem. And we were getting quite close to that, because we were flying it for longer and better than they thought. And so we looked at a program to see exactly what had happened and what was happening with the fuselage, with the systems, with the controls. And then if anything needed doing, we put together a relifing program to add more cycles to the guarantee in agreement with the manufacturers. We found that the aircraft, because of the altitude and the heat, the skin was very dry, there was very little corrosion. What little corrosion there was where the designers said it would be, which is always very reassuring. We put in place the possibility of a major program to change the major parts of the aircraft, and we didn't have to do it. It was in amazingly good condition. We flew some test flights with the aircraft. I flew them taking us around the edge and outside of the flight envelope to try extreme handling occasionally, not too extreme, but to take it beyond what would normally be flown. That was fine. We put some test equipment on a scheduled service flight for 6 months. All of that was fine. And so we developed a really efficient and relatively low-cost program to extend the life. We got some more cycles out of the system. And the deal was that when we got to the end of those, we'd relife again and we'd check it, and it would be a constant monitoring process. And I think there's every reason to believe that the aircraft themselves could still be flying now and probably could still be flying for another 5 years or so. So they weren't getting tired as such. In fact, they were hardly used by comparison to a modern high-density subsonic aeroplane. So we were very mindful of the life of the aircraft.
Okay. Who had the question here?
Okay, one for the ladies. Being a flight attendant myself, I've had to deal with some very difficult passengers, and I just wondered if you ever experienced any difficult passengers on Concorde, or were they so thrilled that they all behaved themselves?
Leslie?
Fortunately, most times I didn't have any problem. And because she was such an exciting aeroplane, I think they dissipated their anger. They probably were very fraught before they came on, problems driving up to the airport. But once they actually got on the airplane and settled down and the aircraft took off, usually found the problems dissipated.
Let's let the other ladies answer the same question, because I got to believe with some of the big names that flew in there, you had some uppity ones. Go ahead, Maggie.
Well, there were a couple of sort of small incidents. One was a gentleman who got rather angry because we had run out of the entree dish that he wanted, and he didn't believe us, and he expected us to find one from somewhere, but when we didn't actually have it on board, it was a little difficult. But the other one was rather an interesting one. It wasn't so much a complaint, but we had Madonna on the flight, and she was seated in the second row of the rear cabin, and she had her bodyguards with her. And they were standing at the bulkhead, which is located close to the toilets. And sometimes there was a bit of a queue for the toilets. And this gentleman was standing there, another passenger. And he was looking at Madonna, as one would, I guess. And one of the bodyguards got quite sort of stroppy and said, "What are you looking at?" But apart from that, it was all right. But I felt a bit sorry for the guy, because obviously he wanted to look at Madonna.
I have a question.
Let the last lady ask, the last flight attendant to answer that question, then we'll get to the next one.
In my flying experience as a cabin service director on Concorde, I found most of the customers on board were very loyal to the aircraft. If we had delays, they seemed to support us, and they wanted Concorde to succeed in all its flights. Any issues with delays, they were with you all the time. They were very much involved in the Concorde aircraft at all times, I've had.
Very good, thank you.
Could okay. I just chuck in half a cent's worth here on the same subject?
Absolutely.
I think our cabin crews managed to engender in a feeling in most of the passengers, almost being part of the whole operation, almost, you might say, a clubby sort of atmosphere. I mean, in the good old days, the flight deck door was always open and we had many, many visitors. It was routine, it was expected. You very rarely did a flight without some visitors. And we could pick up on that in the flight deck, this sort of atmosphere and a feeling of togetherness.
Okay, now we'll take that next question.
Question?
Let's do it here.
Yes, in looking at Concorde and its capabilities, it almost seems purpose-built for flying across the Atlantic. And of course, that would limit its utility overall to airlines, it would seem to me at least. I understand that there was a Concorde B in planning, and actually it was supposed to go into production after the first 16 Concordes that were developed, but then of course the funding stopped. Concorde B was supposed to have the capability of flying the Pacific Ocean as well. Do you think that there is perhaps a rush to get the plane in the air before it was fully capable, and that may have limited its attractiveness to airlines in some ways?
Dave, yeah, no.
Well, I'll do the second bit. I think probably Dave will do the Concorde B bit. But the question was it rushed? Anything but rushed. I mean, the idea and the concept of Concorde goes back to the late 1940s, in an era when the world's first passenger carrying jet aircraft, the Comet, had only just test flown and actually in 1952 flew with passengers on a scheduled service for the first time. That's when the idea for Concorde, and in that era, then the idea of carrying 100 people across the Atlantic at twice the speed of sound was nearly as far-fetched as going to the moon. So it wasn't limited in its when it came out. It actually met exactly what it was designed for. The fact that by the time 30 years later came by, we wish perhaps it had done a little bit, been a bit more challenging, I think is just the benefit of hindsight. So I don't think there's anything to regret there, but Dave could probably fill in a bit more about Concorde B and what might have been.
Yes, one of the points is that at some particular point in time, you've got to stop drawing and start building, you know, freeze your first production model. And after all, the airplane was in test for 6.5 years, 5,500 hours, a long gestation period, but it was basically two different airplanes in one, an airplane that was capable of full subsonic flight, and then the high speed, high altitude, high temperature one with all its attendant problems. But the B model, yes, would have liked to have had the B model. The little I know about it was, in the brochure, they use the yardstick of non-stop Rome to New York. So that would be including the subsonic leg over Europe and still have the fuel, the range to get to New York. It was going to have a completely different leading edge with a leading edge device, you know, a slat or something like that, leading edge flap. Different shaped wingtips. In other words, they were cleaning up the aerodynamics. All these were down on paper, after the design freeze, but they were all too fundamental to the airplane to actually apply retrospectively as performance improvements, although we did a number of performance improvements to the airplane during its life.
You mentioned earlier on the importance of the flight engineer, and could you expand upon that, the workload and perhaps even compare it to the flight engineer's workload in different aircraft?
Yes, I suppose I better answer that one first off. I mean, I think Tony was being a little over generous with his estimations of the workload. The fact is that what he doesn't know is I also got 80% more of the pay, but never mind. Things will out. No, we ran a fully integrated crew, as you would expect. I mean, I would have been as adept at discussing automatic landing limits and vortex lift, just as Tony and Ian and Norman and Dave would have been discussing e-schedules and center of gravity control. I guess most here will have seen the flight deck, or if not, pictures of it. And by today's standards, it's quite different. Many, many controls, many, many manual functions, not that much automation. A concentrated flight time, so you're getting through the same sort of work functions on a transatlantic flight in just 3.25 hours, as opposed to, say, 7.25 to 8. So you had to have a different mindset. You know, trundling along at 22 miles a minute, things tended to happen more quickly. There were some conventional things, the hydraulic systems, electrics, air conditioning were more conventional. And then the twiddly bits, the real magic being the air intakes. Automatic in operation, 2 control channels designed by a guided weapons company. But then there was a manual reversion where you could use inching controls to position the shock waves in front of the intake just where you wanted them to increase the efficiency of the whole power plant. There were new things to learn, new problems to meet with the inherent temperature, the inherent vibration of the airplane. It was a lot of fun. Just simply a lot of fun and a wonderful airplane to be on, whether flight engineer or pilot or cabin crew.
Having flown Concorde twice, and I felt very privileged to do that, I can tell you he's full of beans. They were busy nonstop. They didn't have time to breathe, because I know when we were allowed to go up to the cockpit, the flight attendants always said, "Don't talk to the flight engineer. He's too damn busy."
So it was your fault, was it, that nobody would talk to me?
There's another issue too, that in our pilot's license, it's the only license certainly in the UK and probably in the world that said this airplane can only be flown with a qualified flight engineer. You weren't allowed
Norman,
to have a
Norman, pilot. That was just your license.
I would also like to add the flight engineer was quite busy too, because we're too busy looking out the window and he had to write all the weather down for us. And when he wasn't doing that, he was passing the food up. Dave did this very nicely, but the odd flight engineer would help himself to the odd chop or sausage off my plate, certainly. And one other point, they've mentioned this course this, that they did before we joined the our course ourselves, and they said it was to do secrets things and to learn things that pilots were too stupid to understand. And our view was that because they were going on such a smart airplane, that they had to learn to do joined-up writing.
Thank you.
There's one other thing that made the flight engineer extremely important. He was between everything else and the two pilots. So if you treated him badly or misbehaved or he didn't like you, you didn't even get a cup of tea.
There is, I think, excuse me, I wasn't belittling the captains and things like that. I mean, pilots, generally speaking, take a lot of kudos, and rightly so, when you consider the Hudson River, Sioux City, and things like that. But generally speaking, you know, in the day-to-day running, when the aeroplane is working absolutely normally, I mean, the engineer's job, in fact, in balancing the fuel, because it's absolutely vital that the aircraft is kept in trim. But as Dave said, it's a fully integrated crew. When you look at the flight deck situation, you see Dave there, the first officer sitting here, was on the right-hand side. Well, no matter how hard I tried, I couldn't look around and see anything. So when something jumps out of the woodwork and causes a problem, the whole operation is managed by the captain, Norman or Dave, with this Dave here, and the co-pilot or the first officer will actually fly the airplane, be responsible for the navigation, the radio calls. So you're actually running completely as a three-man team, and that's really the way it seems to work.
Well, this is for Captain Tony. Tony, you mentioned that you were a VC-10 pilot. This must go way back, because I was on a flight from Nairobi, Kenya, in 1966 to London with a possible fuel landing in Khartoum. And the flight took off about 8 o'clock at night from Nairobi. We were in 2 hours into the flight, and the captain came back to the rear cockpit. I was about one row from the toilet. And we got into a conversation, and he asked me if I was a pilot, and I said I was a private pilot at the time. And we were talking, he was said he was a Spitfire pilot during World War II. So he invited me to come up to the cockpit, and I came up there, and I thought just a view. He said, "Go ahead and sit in the left seat." So I sat down in the left seat, and we carried on our conversation for 3 hours, didn't have to do a fuel stop in Khartoum. We crossed the Mediterranean, crossed into France, and the co-pilot finally looked back and a little bit concerned. He says, "Captain, we've been cleared in the airspace of England." And Captain asked me, he says, I better go sit in the left seat now." So I had a 3-hour flight, and I want to thank you for my appreciation to the VC-10 pilots and the captains.
Yeah, those are things, you know, we wouldn't admit to today. A lot of things we got away with many, many years ago. Nowadays, it's not worth it when things, you know, when things can jump out of the woodwork, it's at short notice.
Hi, this question's geared towards the pilots, Buddy can answer. Like a little while back online, I read about a story about a Concorde that ran out of fuel, were taxiing from the runway to the gate after a flight, and the pilot was fired for that. And I was just wondering if this little incident was true, or if it was just an urban legend.
Believe everything you see on the internet, right?
Absolutely. I think I would pass it over to Dave Rowland, actually.
It's partly true.
That's a half answer. Any other questions? Okay. While I'm walking back here, I'll wait till we get to this question. Hang on.
For the ladies, I'm curious, what was the cuisine like in the cabin for the passengers?
We had some very exotic food, caviar, smoked salmon, lobsters, just as an appetizer. And then in the very early days, we would serve breakfast of devil kidneys, eggs, bacon, steaks, you name it, it was wonderful. Then as the airplane progressed in years, a lot of our business passengers didn't really want to eat that much. They were there to get from A to B in the quickest possible time, and they had a lot of work to do while they were there. So they quite often wanted something a little bit more simple, and so British Airways adapted to their needs, although other people also had a choice of equally exotic meals.
There's nothing really to say other than Leslie has described it extremely well, but the food was always very good, very high standard, and with quite a lot of choice considering the capacity that we had to store the food. But we didn't have any complaints about the food as far as I'm aware. It was always very well presented. And not just because of us.
One thing they haven't mentioned, they worked in the most appalling conditions, tight, small galleys, no headroom, pilots coming back for tea because we'd been waiting for more longer than a couple of minutes. And in fact, they did a fantastic job in the most difficult conditions.
Hungry, yes.
I think we're running out of time. I think the entire aviation community was very saddened when the Air France plane crashed in 2000. And then on that July 25th in 2003, when every Concorde was grounded forever. I'd like to have each one of you address your feelings when that happened and whether we lost our supersonic adventures for commercial aviation for good. Or are we on a temporary hold right now? Dave, you can start.
Far be it for me, Jerry, to kind of just correct you. It was October 2003 when the last flight took place.
Okay, I'm sorry.
And the last flight ever was in, excuse me, in November 2003 when the last British Concorde landed back at Filton, where it had been manufactured and where it's now kept. It seems to me that in the evolution of man, really, especially in the engineering and science field, every time we've actually stopped doing something, we've moved on to do something better. We've moved forward every time. Probably since the wheel was invented, we've moved forward as we've gone through history. And this seems to me, to paraphrase one of your great heroes in this country, a giant step backwards for mankind, in that none of you can do what we were doing 30 years ago, to fly supersonically across the Atlantic in sometimes less than 3 hours. That's a giant step backwards as far as I'm concerned, and I just hope that the young generation pick up the challenge, and it is a challenge, and actually produce another generation of aircraft so that we can actually move forward again.
Of course I was appalled, but it wasn't quite so bad because I'd already left the fleet, so I wasn't losing anything directly at that moment. But I've also done a little bit of work with Boeing and their flight control laws with their version of the supersonic transport. And I think that we've gone as far as we're going to go, and certainly in my lifetime, and I'm very, very saddened.
I was equally saddened. I'd also left the fleet in 2003. But when they stopped the Concorde, I did hope and prayed that maybe there would be one Concorde that would be left for special occasions, demonstrations, whether it be the British Concorde or even the French Concorde. It would have been wonderful to have one that could still fly.
Yes, equally very saddened, and having had 13 years, wonderful years, flying on the aeroplane, to think that we were never going to see her again. She was the most incredible aeroplane, as we all know, to look at. Everybody wanted to see her, and the thought that we won't see her again in the sky is very sad indeed. And it would be wonderful if somebody could come up with one that we could enjoy.
I actually cried, and I thought it was very unfair to ground Concorde, the whole fleet, both with Air France and British Airways. And I still dream that in my lifetime I will see Concorde rise again to the skies.
Yes, much the same feelings. I mean, the horror of seeing the video or the film of the aircraft crashing, even though we weren't personally involved with the people on board, or in fact I wasn't on the fleet either. But after that, of course, I'd be asking, well, what happened? You know, how did it happen? I'm sure all of you pilots would have been asked the same questions. You know, what do you think caused the crash? And very sad that it ended up with all the aircraft being grounded, and eventually, for several other reasons, the fleet not continuing, the aircraft not continuing in service. So, yeah, terribly sad. And many of us very sad that we'll never fly on the aircraft again, or even see it. So maybe we can get one flying again, or even taxiing around the airfield, maybe.
Well, on the question of the Air France accident, can't quite describe any particular emotion. But when I saw that crushed flight deck upside down on the ground, a place that I knew intimately from 20 years of association, both sitting in the seat in the cockpit and helping the project in other ways too. It was a quite indescribable emotion. On the question of future flights, well, there are two things here. When I knew a lot of the people down at Bristol at the aircraft factory and at the engine factory, and when we took the airplanes, knowing that there were only going to be 7 British-built ones and 7 in France, knowing that we, as British taxpayers, had paid for them, there was an overriding feeling of wanting to do the best for the airplane and for all the people who'd slaved almost half a lifetime in designing, testing and producing that airplane. And I think it's fair to say that we probably did that over 27 years, more than a lot of people would have thought. The other aspect is legacy, and I guess most of us in a career would like to think that we leave some little legacy behind. I suppose the lucky ones are the ones who build bridges and things like that, a visible legacy. I think we will have a legacy left behind. It may not be in the air for a few years to come, but at least it's in the archives, and it's all there for when we get that quiet engine.
Well, there's been a couple of mentions down here about the wish list for the aeroplane to fly. Now, our friends have left the theatre, so allegedly they've left the theatre. But allegedly, there is a...
Well, on the question of the Air France accident, can't quite describe any particular emotion. But when I saw that crushed flight deck upside down on the ground, a place that I knew intimately from 20 years of association, both sitting in the seat in the cockpit and helping the project in other ways too. It was a quite indescribable emotion. On the question of future flights, well, there are two things here. When I knew a lot of the people down at Bristol at the aircraft factory and at the engine factory, And when we took the airplanes, knowing that there were only going to be 7 British-built ones and 7 in France, knowing that we, as British taxpayers, had paid for them, there was an overriding feeling of wanting to do the best for the airplane and for all the people who'd slaved half a lifetime in designing, testing and producing that airplane. And I think it's fair to say that we probably did that. Over 27 years, it's more than a lot of people would have thought. The other aspect is legacy. And I guess most of us in a career would like to think that we leave some little legacy behind. I suppose the lucky ones are the ones who build bridges and things like that, a visible legacy. I think we will have a legacy left behind. It may not be in the air for a few years to come, but at least it's in the archives, and it's all there for when we get that quiet engine.
Well, there's been a couple of mentions down here about the wish list for the aeroplane to fly. Now, our friends have left the theatre, so allegedly they've left the theatre, but allegedly there is a Concorde that does engine runs quite frequently in Toulouse. Now, the rules of the game were, after the treaty with France, that all the engine oil and the hydraulic oil lines had to be drained, therefore the aeroplanes basically couldn't be resurrected again. But there, allegedly in France, a lady engineer, twice a week, runs the engines and moves the controls. Watch this space. But the sad thing for me is that I stand and tell my children, my grandchildren and my children, and I say, we used to fly to New York in 3 hours and 15 minutes.
Last question. Tony, I asked you earlier and you said you wanted to keep it for the end. Any incident in 46 years that just jumps out at you? Folks, you might want to get your hankies out on this one.
It doesn't have to happen on an aeroplane in which you fly. You may know that the Concorde did trips to Barbados from the mid-December to roughly mid-April every year, every Saturday out and Saturday back again. We used to position backwards and forwards on the jumbo, operating, taking up space for commercial space. And it was agreed, we made an agreement with the company that we'd stay in Barbados. So basically at the beginning of the season, you would put position one crew to Barbados on the Friday, the Saturday they would fly it back again, and then every week the crews would shuttle backwards and forwards. And by the time I left the fleet, I was quite senior on there, therefore I was able to get a lot of flights to Barbados, and I actually did the last flight out. And therefore, on the next day, I was going to come back first class on the jumbo. Now, British Airways has always had fantastic, actually, service on the aeroplane, and it is the best of the best, creme de la creme. So I'm positioning back, and usually, as the flight crew on Concorde, we were given first class seats. And we come into the aeroplane, we come down, and it's absolutely magic, you know. And the cabin crew are brilliant because they didn't know us, but they know from where we're sitting, they remember names, every attention to detail. I want you to get this. It's absolutely there. So they take our coats, and we're standing around, and I'm standing around here talking to the captain and the engineer. And you know, she asks, would we like a glass of champagne? Well, of course, it's Dom Perignon or something like that, so you're going to have champagne. And we're just chatting away, and I was totally unprepared for what was going to happen. She came up to me, and she passed me the glass. We were chatting, and I acknowledged the glass, and we're chatting away like this, and on towards somebody else's aeroplane, and I put the glass to my lips, and just as I get up there, this incident, I go, oh, God, it was warm. What? Isn't that the worst thing that can happen to you on an aeroplane? Yeah.
All right, that's it. This is a Concorde reunion.
Thank you, guys, please.
I want to tell you that I love Tony's idea about bringing the remaining Concorde here. I think it's a doable thing. If I had $1 million, Tony, I would give you a check right now.
Oh, well, thank you.
Okay.
I'll accept it.
It would bounce like mad.